Constitution says that if you're born here, if you're naturalized, you can vote. So I think that we should confer a voter identification number to every person upon birth or naturalization and do away with the idea that they have to take a specific action to register. That way we clean up all of the problems with duplicate registrations in multiple states and all of the integrity issues that come about with different states doing the same thing in different ways and all that other kind of stuff.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Ken Block is a computer data expert and entrepreneur, the owner of Simpatico Software Systems. He's a political reformer and former candidate for governor in Rhode Island. He's the author of a book called Disproven, My Unbiased Search for Voter Fraud for the Trump Campaign, the data that shows why he lost and how we can improve our elections. In the book, he recounts in detail the story of how he was hired as an expert by the campaign's lawyer, but found no significant fraud. I really enjoyed this interview. You should listen. So, after a quick word from my sponsor, my interview with Ken Block of Disproven.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Ken, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. My name is Ken Block. I'm the guy the Trump campaign hired to look for voter fraud immediately after the 2020 election. I am a technology entrepreneur here in Rhode Island. I specialize in large database systems. In my resume, I have built the country's first online food stamp benefits delivery system for the state of Texas. This is the first welfare debit card system that was statewide, and I've done that same job for California, Illinois, government of Puerto Rico. I've developed a specialty in looking at voter data over the last decade. I'm pretty sure that that expertise is the reason that I got the phone call from the Trump campaign asking me to help them look for voter fraud.
So you grew up in Rhode Island?
No, I grew up a world away in Connecticut. I had not been to Rhode Island until I came down here for a contract back in the early 90s. That nine-month contract has led to basically 30 years of living here.
How did you get into computers in the first place?
That's a great story. My mother's uncle was a man named Alan Perlman, and he had invented one of the first electronic synthesizers called the ARP, A-R-P. And he bought me an Apple II computer, one of the first Apple computers that was ever made. And I started noodling around with it when I was in high school, and I really liked it. I haven't stopped playing with computers since.
Did you learn 6502 assembler?
I have worked with a couple of different assembly languages. I couldn't tell you the specifics going all the way back then.
I only asked because it's such a parallel with my own experience, which is my parents bought an Apple II Plus around 81, and I started doing the same noodling. And I saw you went to Dartmouth and got a bachelor's in computer science. I went to Yale, got a BA in computer science also, 1 year off in our times there. So,
oh, nice. Yes, very similar experience.
Yes. And I think it was that kind of experience at a time when it was much less common to be interested in that kind of thing. The personal computer was new. It was much more rare for people to have them. What do you think it was about it that caught your fancy?
I like the fact that I can make it do the things that I can envision it to do. There's a real satisfaction in getting the machinery to produce the outcome that you can see in your head. And I love architecting large systems. That's the main thing that we do in my practice today with our customers, with a very sharp focus on database performance. So I like playing with gigantic databases and making them go fast.
When I look at your early career, it says engineer, 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 president. Tell me a little bit about your evolution as someone who is doing the work to someone who, it sounds like, starts to go into leading it as much as doing it. What's going on there?
I've held positions of leadership throughout the travel of my career as a full-time employee of other businesses. When we built the Lone Star card system for the state of Texas, which, by the way, is still in operation today, I was one of the chief architects of that solution at the time, even though I didn't have my own business running at that point. I realized early on that I brought to the table skills that allowed me to be very good at what I did from an engineering perspective, but I also had an ability to speak well, to handle customers and everything else that comes along with having your own business. And I'm a person, which I'm sure will come out multiple times during this conversation today, I'm a big believer in meritocracy. I think that you should achieve your goals and you should be rewarded based on the merits, not necessarily based on corporate politics and that sort of thing. And corporate politics is the reason that I realized as soon as I could, I had to launch my own business to be free of that sort of thing. And once I had my own businesses up and running, I've never looked back, and it would be very difficult for me to fold myself back into another corporate culture.
What was the first business that was yours that you launched, and when was that?
My three technology businesses have all been sort of continuations of each other. The first go around was called Kinetic Consulting. That was back in the mid 90s. We did a lot of work in the gaming industry. Subsequent to that, we rolled Kinetic into another company, and we called that whole thing Kinetrix. This was all during the dot-com insanity. Did that for just a small couple of years. And then I fired up Simpatico Software Systems in the 2001, 2002. That's been my main business and passion.
Be fair to call that mainly a government contracting company?
No, government contracting is the smallest slice of our revenues. Most of the revenues are from private industry.
And what's the range of sort of the work that you do? Obviously, database sounds like is a key part of it, but what's the range of sort of clients and jobs?
The range is we've done web applications for human resources applications. We have tons of experience in the gaming industry and do a lot of work for the gaming industry. I've done data mining for fraud in government benefits programs, food stamps. A lot of people know it as SNAP. I still call it food stamps. Medicaid, that sort of thing. There's a number of different things. Everyone on my staff has a specialty, but also can be very effective as a generalist. And we deliver pretty big projects with a pretty relatively small staff.
How big a staff typically?
I've yet to do a project through my companies that required more than 12 people.
How would you characterize your politics growing up?
I didn't have any. I really didn't. Politics wasn't something we talked all that much about. My dad did run for the school committee at one point, unsuccessfully. I'm pretty sure he ran as a Democrat. Both my parents were committed Democrats, but it wasn't a passionate topic, and it certainly wasn't anything. I didn't wake up politically until, you know, well into probably my 30s, honestly.
It seems to be true for a lot of technical people that they are kind of in the world of business and technology, and politics is almost like a dirty word.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because politics is a dirty word for a lot of polite company. While there are many people who are passionate about politics, there are a great many people who aren't. And while they will fulfill their obligation and duty to vote, they don't play it as a blood sport, and it's not a continuing topic of conversation. There's much more passion about politics now than there was 15, 20 years ago. But I still know an awful lot of people who kind of wish the whole mess would.
Got to figure out who's going to run the country and the states and so on. It's a better way than fighting each other with swords, I think. You did, however, get yourself involved in politics in Rhode Island in a whole series of ways. What was the first thing you tackled?
After I became politically aware, it was from the viewpoint of business owner in what was widely considered one of the worst states in the country in which to run a business. And I started paying attention because taxes were slaughtering me. What I was fond of saying at the time was that I could move to Taxachusetts, which had a national reputation of having at the time exceedingly high taxes, that I could run to Taxachusetts for tax relief because Rhode Island's situation was even worse. So that's kind of how I became initially involved in politics. And then quickly, as I started paying attention to how things got done in Rhode Island, which is a single party state, it's the bluest state in the country, and the legislature is shockingly monolithic. I think out of 113 legislators, we usually have no more than 15 Republicans. I firmly believe that competition is good in every aspect of our lives. And when there's not good political competition, things stagnate and bad stuff starts to happen. I started getting involved in government reform type ideas. How we voted in Rhode Island was really the first real political issue that I took up. At the time, we had single party voting happening in Rhode Island, where when you go into the voting booth, you can just vote by party. You don't even have to pick the names or know who's running. You just vote red or vote blue and walk out. And that struck me as a terrible way to vote. And advocates have been at it for 50 years to get rid of it. I felt strongly that just because it was such a ridiculous idea and so few states still had it, it was should have been a no-brainer to get rid of it. And I engaged hard, and it took 6 to 7 years after I got involved to finally push it to the point where the master lever went away. Single party voting, master lever, we kind of interchangeably use those terms.
The machine lever or something.
Machine lever, yeah.
Yeah.
That was my first experience with the frustration of trying to get anything done inside the legislature.
What I thought was fascinating about that, where you talked about it a little bit in the book, was that you got a hold of the actual returns. I think it was from the 2010 election, right? And by looking at them and seeing, first of all, it wasn't used that much, which surprised me, but also it seemed like it was obvious that it was confusing some members of the public also, even though it's not that complicated an idea. People were both essentially checking the machine lever and voting for parties, candidates of parties that were different from what they had indicated they were voting straight ticket, right?
Yeah, I mean, the easiest explanation is that, so I was a candidate for governor in 2010 for the new political party that I managed to launch in Rhode Island after challenging the constitutionality of the state's ballot access laws and winning. When we were invited to look at those ballots in 2012, I realized that it was a unique opportunity to look at, in a relatively small community, what the impact of those master lever votes were on my campaign for governor. And as we dug into it, what became very clear, boiling it down to one sentence, voters were not using single party voting for the purposes of casting a vote. They were using single party voting as a way to identify what their political philosophy was, because they were saying they were moderates and they were using the moderate single party vote mechanism, but then they were overriding for the three moderates on the ballot. They voted for none of them, most of the ballot. So that's that particular problem right there is the direct reason why we were ultimately successful getting rid of single party voting in Rhode Island.
A lot of people gripe about the two major parties, but not that many people found another one in their state.
And there's a good reason for that.
And I know it's not easy. It's not easy to get on the ballot. It's not easy to make it successful. That's a whole other ball of wax. But what was your motivation for that? And why call it the moderate party? And what were you trying to do?
I really, and of course, we're in a much worse situation today than we were back in 2009. I didn't like the partisanship that was going on at the time. I felt that more time was being spent by our elected leaders just screwing around with the other party as opposed to getting things done. I always felt like I was voting for the lesser of two evils when I voted. And it was my sense that people were ready for another choice at the ballot. And a lot of the people I know don't consider themselves hyper-partisans on one side or the other. That's different now, but at the time, they didn't feel that way. And it seemed logical, and I'm a pathetically logical guy. And it seemed logical to me that a centrist political party focused in on actual issues would make sense. It made sense to me, and I felt it should make sense to others. And that's why I decided to go down a incredibly difficult road. And I probably should have known better once I realized the only way to be successful was to file a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the laws. But once I have a challenge, I'm kind of like a dog on a bone. And it felt very wrong to me that the state had nested their laws together in the way they did to prevent just what I was trying to do. And I decided that I would just follow it all the way through, and I did.
You definitely seem like a persistent person. Hey, did you run across a professor at Dartmouth? He would have been there substantially after you, but he might have been a student with you. Charlie Whelan, who had something called the Centrist Manifesto and has written a bunch of books.
I've read his book. He and I communicate every once in a while. Yeah, absolutely.
He had an experience of running for Congress, and he's an early guest on my show, but he had experience running for Congress where he just felt like he probably could win a general, but he couldn't win the nomination, and very frustrated by trying to tackle that from the middle.
Yeah, I have that direct experience in 2014 running in the Republican primary for governor. I lost my race by just 3,000 votes. I can't describe to you how painful that is. You know, had I come out of that primary, it would have been a very interesting general election. But.
So tell me about the two runs. The first run, you run as a moderate on your own party ticket and get just enough to qualify the party.
We did 5% and I got 6.5%.
Probably working pretty darn hard to get those
6.5%. Oh my gosh, you have no idea. Yes.
Yes. Tell me about that process of running and what you thought. I mean, you probably were in the first run, we're not thinking I got a chance of being governor, but I don't know, but it's tough. Tell me about that run and what it took from you.
I wasn't deluded. Okay. So we spent a lot of time trying to get anybody else to run for governor. And there were a lot of people who did run for governor in that race in 2010 in Rhode Island. It really came down in February of 2010, with just months to go to the election, where the executive committee of the political party basically turned to me and said, you have to run, because even though we qualified the party by collecting 35,000 signatures, the only way we could keep the party would be to go through that effort again after the election. And I've collected many signatures over the years, but I don't ever want to have to collect that many ever again. Or you have to get 5% of the vote. As your candidate for governor has to get 5% of the vote. That's easy for Democrats. It's easy for Republicans. It's brutally difficult for anybody else. So I went into it with no name recognition in February of 2010, other than the couple of news stories about my legal fight against the state of Rhode Island. I was very fortunate in that we had about 40 forums and debates between the four primary candidates, and I was considered a primary candidate in that race. There were 7 or 8 people all in, but 4 that were doing it with any level of seriousness. I did exceedingly well at the debates, which helped me a lot. I became known as somebody who enjoyed the debates, communicated clearly, and people liked my approach to things, and that's how I got the 6.5% that was needed. But that took everything. And that was only a campaign of 9 months. And that was so hard. But I was so fired up. Every part of my being was fired up by the challenge of it, by the intellectual challenge of debates, communication. You know, I don't like interrupting people when they're eating breakfast in a diner and walking in a parade and trying to shake 5,000 hands. That is absolutely not a natural thing for most people to do. I was dragged kicking and screaming to doing that piece of it, but all the rest of it, I actually really enjoyed.
I don't know the results in that race. Was the race between the two major candidates closer than 6.5%? Do you think it affected the results at all?
So the setup was there was a Democrat, there was a Republican, and then there was an independent by the name of Lincoln Chafee. So Chafee was a senator, former senator in Rhode Island. His father was John Chafee, who was also a senator, was a governor. And Chafee spent a ton of money. He spent a fortune on that race. And he won it with 38% of the vote. The Republican came in second place and lost by a number that was smaller than the 6.5% that I won. And there was a lot of griping in Republican circles that I was responsible for the loss. But that's not where my votes came from. Where my votes came from was the Democrat, Frank Caprio, was another machine party person. Nice guy. And he tried to get Barack Obama to endorse his candidacy. But Obama and Chafee served in the Senate together and they had a personal relationship, and Obama wouldn't endorse the Democrat, Caprio. So Caprio got really frustrated and told Obama to shove it via the media. And he lost about 8 points when he did that. I know that a good chunk of my vote came from disaffected Caprio voters. And he was kind of a blue dog Democrat. He definitely wasn't in the progressive wing of the party. So it was very weird. Chafee ran to the left of everybody.
It does seem a strange time to run a moderate party when you have an independent in the race who's well known and a Democrat who's a blue dog. It almost feels like there wasn't the right ideological slot for that party at that time, or am I wrong?
Well, when I started the process of starting the party, we had no idea who any candidate was going to be. It took a year to get the legal stuff out of the way.
But still, you're naming a party moderate. It sounds like you're trying to place it in between the two parties that exist. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's about lack of partisanship and about a focus in on the quality of life issues that we all care about. That was the positioning of it.
So to run the next time as a Republican, what were you thinking?
What I was thinking was that, for starters, trying to do something with the moderate party post 2010 was exceedingly difficult. Donors still weren't sure about whether it made any sense to give to the party. Some did, but a lot didn't. A lot of people were just confused by the whole idea of a third party. Many people just by default think third parties are just crazy across the board. And the candidates that the party attracted, for the most part, were either stalking horse candidates put up by the other parties to be essentially bad candidates for the moderates, or they had their own idiosyncrasies that made them not great candidates. So I realized after 2012 that it just wasn't a good vehicle to affect change. And living in a state where the Democrats have a stranglehold on power across the board, the reforms, the things I want to get done, are impossible to get done from within the Democratic machine. The only feasible place for me to go after making the changes that I thought were necessary to make was to use the Republican Party vehicle as the place to run. And I paid the price for that decision as well, because even though it was exceedingly close, I was painted as not a true conservative. I'm a Rockefeller Republican in most things. I'm very conservative fiscally, not current fiscal conservatism, but real fiscal conservatism. You know, on the social issues, I'm pretty libertarian. You know, just leave us alone, right? I mean, it's very hard for me to describe my political philosophy to most people.
The candidate that narrowly beat you in the 2014 Republican primary, what was the difference between you?
Well, the really remarkable thing is I had fun in 2010. That campaign was awesome. I had no fun at all in 2014. It was very personal. There was a lot of attacks. It was ugly. And the guy I ran against, who by no means can be considered a hard right politician, ran as one in order to win the primary. It just was no fun at all. And it was really a disingenuous campaign on his part, just the way he positioned himself. And then for all of the deeply personal attacks that were happening, he lost his general, and his margin of loss was almost exactly the amount of support I had in the primary. It's not surprising to me that the folks who voted for me would never vote for him.
So in a certain way, who he catered to alienated him from the general electorate.
100%.
Yeah. I mean, it's a interesting microcosm of elections around the country happening there in Rhode Island. Sometimes the party names are switched, but.
Right. It's all the same. And what I have learned through looking so carefully at election processes and data across the country, whoever holds the reins of power are going to take actions that benefit those who hold the reins to keep the reins. And it doesn't matter if it's Republican or Democrat. When you have a single party dominance, that party will do bad things to make sure that they keep it. That's something that I know we're going to get to it at some point, but that's something we have to break. We need competitive elections and we don't have it right now.
Before you got the phone call from the Trump campaign to help them, what was your experience with election returns and things that might pertain to the whole fraud question in the 2020 election? What led them to come to you? What did you already know before?
Well, so I have looked at duplicate and deceased voters, identifying them credibly and accurately for years. I have a known expertise in doing that.
You've done that under contract for other entities?
I have. I used Rhode Island as my election lab guinea pig. At the time, there were only 600,000-800,000 registered voters. So it's a place where you can play with data and the cost isn't too extraordinarily bad. I'm considered serious enough by most here in the state that when I bring something to their attention, they'll hear me out at a minimum. And Rhode Island deserves some kudos because over the years, I've identified a couple thousand deceased registered voters that they cleaned up. They took my list and they did their research and they cleaned them up. So I have that in my background. I can't tell you exactly why the campaign called me. I don't know who told Alex Cannon, the lawyer who reached out to me, to do so. I didn't have the time to really get into a lot of chit chat with him once we started looking at the frauds for the campaign, because we had a tiny window of 35 days in which to do about 6 months worth of work.
Did you happen to see a film about election workers in Rhode Island, a documentary called No Time to Fail?
No.
You might look at that. It's just a very interesting behind the scenes look at what it's like to be an election worker in Rhode Island. It happened to be guests on my show, and I thought it was super interesting just to see how seriously public servants in these positions take their jobs and try to get things right. And people ought to know about that existing out there. But getting a call, to go back to our train of thought here, getting that call from the Trump campaign, what was your attitude towards the Trump campaign at that point? Like, had you been a supporter? Had you qualms about the election? What were you thinking?
My role for the campaign was very clearly defined.
But I asked a different question. I asked about, like, how did you feel? I read your book. I understand why you took it. I think it makes sense, and I'm glad you did it. But what I'm wondering is just like, what was in your mind about the campaign at that time?
Yeah. So I'm going to decline to answer that for the simple reason, and there's a really good reason for it. My role and this book's role in the national dialogue right now is the delivery of some really crucial facts. And I have to remain completely neutral as a personality talking about this information, because while your listeners won't have the slightest problem appreciating the data I'm bringing forward and trusting it and believing it, conservatives is another problem altogether. In fact, right now, I can't even have the conversation with conservative media about this. The difficulty I currently have having that conversation could potentially be compounded by beginning to have conversations about partisanship and issues that are outside of the important topic of what really happened and why was there no fraud. I'm begging off all of those questions about my personal viewpoints on politics and the candidates at the time, because I can't have those conversations and still have the hope of having my information be well received.
Okay, fair enough. So you get a call from Alex Cannon, who is a lawyer for the Trump campaign. And in your book, you sort of distinguish between multiple factions in the campaign, more grounded in reality, and others who are more enthusiastic about pursuing claims of fraud that are less tested or clear. And Alex represented the more, from my reading, the more sensible side of things. It's right after the election. It's a very charged time. Tell me about how you got going and what the arrangement was.
Alex called me out of the blue and on my cell phone. I don't know how he got my number. As he surprised me with asking me, and after I talked to my wife and daughter about it, and I got back to him the next day, we started just working on the fundamentals of what the engagement could look like. And the important ones for me were that he understood that I wasn't promising a specific result, right? I would find what there was to find, but I wouldn't find what couldn't be found. And he understood that and was accepting of it. He told me that on his side, he would make sure that I stayed sheltered from political pressure. Because to do a job like this straight up means you can't be pressured to deliver results that aren't there. So he kept my identity, the identity of my company, secret from folks upstream from him, which I'm very thankful for because it really enabled me to do a very important job. And that job, from Alex's perspective even, was helping to vet claims of fraud that were going to be the foundation of lawsuits, because Alex, as a lawyer, had a duty to do this due diligence. And most importantly, he, as an attorney, wasn't going to jeopardize his career by attaching his name to a lawsuit that had a foundation of knowingly bad data. So that was the framework. He wanted me to be as dispassionate and as thorough as I could be, looking at both my work, looking for fraud, and as we were evaluating others' claims of fraud. He wanted the accuracy and he wanted to know the truth about the claims. So you have Alex, you have other lawyers who were paid by the campaign, who were part of the campaign infrastructure. And then you have outside lawyers like Rudy Giuliani, Sidney Powell, John Eastman, who were filing their own lawsuits, even though they said they were on behalf of the campaign. They actually weren't wrapped up. A lot of those weren't wrapped up in the campaign apparatus. And those two groups of lawyers were at each other's throats. And I didn't know it at the time because I was sheltered from all of that and I was too busy to care. But when I did my research for the book and I was reading Cannon's January 6th deposition transcripts, he describes in some detail how his interactions with Cleta Mitchell, another one of the attorneys, were extremely fraught, and that he describes how she was attacking him all the time, probably because I kept blowing up the claims of fraud that were being brought to his attention.
And it seems to me, very much to his credit and to whoever allowed him to do it, that they did take that vetting of claims seriously and that they did employ someone who was trying to do it straight up. As a computer programmer at a time myself and a person who ran a software company, I really enjoyed the detail that you gave about what the challenges are. I mean, I've written routines to find duplicates in databases or match one person with another. And I understand what you were talking about when you're saying, like, if there's missing data, sometimes you can't come to an answer or you get a much larger set of possibilities that have to be vetted and so on. I mean, I sometimes wondered when I was reading your book, even though it was put very clearly, the technical challenges and the findings, I sometimes wondered if the political reporters were always capable of reading that information. I'm not really sure. I think smart people can, for sure.
Yeah, I think it depends. There are definitely interviews I've given to reporters who have understood absolutely everything that I talked about. There's a small couple of interviews where I'm pretty sure that the reporter either just didn't have the time to read the book or wasn't able to absorb a couple of different things that I talked about. It took a long time to write about some of the complex ideas that I wrote about in a very clear, accessible way. And I used my wife and daughter as my audience for whether I was successful at doing that or not. And by and large, even for the most mathematically and technically involved conversation about this mathematical theory that purported to claim that there was massive voter fraud in Pennsylvania, I was able to lay it out in a way that both my wife and daughter understood it and could understand, most importantly, why what they tried to do was wrong.
Was that the Benford's Law thing?
Yeah, that's the Benford's Law thing.
Yeah, I mean, that I think that's fascinating. And it's hard to imagine who could have been better prepared for that, given the work that you were doing in fraud in related areas with big databases, right? Just that doesn't strike me as, I mean, there's a lot of different types of claims that got made by the Trump campaign and its allies about fraud. I don't want you to repeat the book, but could you quickly go through some of the categories? I'm sure you've had to do this a number of times. Go through some of the categories and just say, this is the kind of thing that was there, and this is why it wasn't, didn't work out.
So in broad brush strokes, there were three main categories of problem with the claims. Either the person who did the analysis didn't understand the data they were looking at, didn't understand election processes even in some cases, or they made a fundamental problem with matching where they just looked for people who shared the same name and birth date and assumed it was the same person. That there's a number of fraud claims that fell apart with that. I'm going to get to the last one in just a minute. As far as not understanding what they looked at, the best and most amusing example of that was the very last claim that came to me. And when Alex Cannon brought me the claim to evaluate, he told me over the phone, you know, tell me why this one is wrong. And the claim was that more than 700,000 people in Wisconsin voted twice in Wisconsin. That claim, the analysis was performed by a group of volunteers who made a gigantic, awful mistake. They didn't understand that the data they were looking at was only mail ballots and didn't include the roughly 700,000 in-person votes that were cast in Wisconsin in 2020. That explains the difference. But they got excited. They gave the finding to a friend who played golf, who brought the finding to the manager of a Trump golf course, who gave the finding to Eric Trump, who delivered the finding to Alex Cannon, who gave it to me. Now, this was happening all over the country. And it's bananas, right? And what's most remarkable to me is not that the volunteers made a fundamental mistake. It's easy to make mistakes looking at this data. It's very complicated data. And the election processes are not simple, right? The whole thing is complicated. But not a one of them stopped to think and wonder, that's an awful lot of duplicate votes. Could we possibly be wrong, right? That never happened. And part of everything that we're being challenged with right now when it comes to the discussion of whether or not there's voter fraud and what the impact of voter fraud is there's an element of psychology that's called confirmation bias. And everybody who's been involved, from Mike Lindell to the volunteers in Wisconsin and a whole bunch of other people, they are committed to delivering the proof to the claim by Trump that the election was stolen. And now, why are they so driven to do it? Well, they're driven to do it because they are firm believers that Trump is correct and Trump is doing everything that they want him to be doing, that they think is the right thing to do for the country. And they receive their news from news sources that only give them additional confirmation that their worldviews are correct. And with all of that, you get this industry that's come up where people are almost manically driven to deliver the proof that the election was stolen. And that's really what was underway in 2020, and it persists today because conservatives are still not being exposed to any facts that contradict the worldview that the election was stolen. And it's pretty hard to apply any logic to a situation if you are only hearing one side of the story.
Well, you alluded earlier when I asked you a question you didn't want to answer to the fact that you're not getting heard in that ecosystem. That press ecosystem or media ecosystem. Are you getting any interviews out of the Foxes and the Breitbarts and right-wing podcasts or any of that world?
The closest I got was an interview with the Fox affiliate in DC, Fox 5. I was interviewed by the Epoch Times for an hour. I ended up with two paragraphs in a much larger story. They were good paragraphs, but there was an awful lot of material that we didn't get covered. And the only other conservative exposure I've had was about a year ago when the news of my subpoenas first came out. And the Washington Examiner did a brief story about the fact that I had received a subpoena from Jack Smith. I've tried to get opinion pieces published in some conservative print, and I've not been able to break through.
That's upsetting because it seems like you're so well positioned by having done this for the Trump campaign, by being a Republican contender for office, by being a businessman, by having written a book about this, and by actually being in control of the facts to undermine misinformation that's out there. It does tell us a bit about them that they won't listen to you.
I can't begin to guess the pressures that they're all under. I'm sure there's financial challenges, there's viewership challenges, there's political pressure challenges. Across the board, I'm sure it's not an easy decision to make to have someone like me come on.
It's not a good environment for anyone to put their neck out in opposing Trump that's in Republican world now. It's just not a good environment for that.
What's really important here is that I'm not in actual opposition to him.
No, you're not.
I am broadcasting the facts as I was paid to ascertain them. And that's why I'm staying wholly fact-based here and trying my best through all these different interviews to keep the story to here's what I was asked to do. Here's what I found. And what I ask everybody to remember is that my contract committed me to delivering facts of fraud that would stand up in court, that would survive legal scrutiny. And that was one of the more important contractual clauses that we had, because without that, I could have been exposed to being asked to deliver findings that had nothing to do with going to court or even being factual. So needing to deliver findings that were accurate and defensible was a huge part of what I'm doing. And it's a huge part now of this conversation, because all of the other quote unquote facts that are out there can't be proven, have been booted out of court multiple times. They're what in the legal community we call hearsay evidence, as opposed to fact-based evidence.
I saw someone stuffing a bag into somewhere else. Yeah. If I had to characterize the pattern that I saw when you were recounting different areas that you investigated, it was, here's a somewhat plausible example of fraud. I'm going to look into it in detail. This generates a pretty big number of things to look at that might be it. When we whittle it down to things that actually are fraudulent, we get a very, very tiny number. So like this could happen. It did happen. There were a couple people who voted after they died. Someone voted for their wife. It's not impossible that this could happen at scale, but it didn't. And you show how that happens. Did I get that right?
You got that right. So we found a dozen or fewer examples of deceased votes that were cast in most of the swing states. We found a couple of hundred examples of duplicate votes cast where someone voted once in one of the swing states and once in some other state. We didn't have a complete set of data, and nobody had access to a complete set of data in the 35-day window post-election. And here's one of the big points about all of this. Any candidate's ability to successfully challenge an election result has to be made from election day up until the day that the votes are certified in the state. Once the votes are certified, you can't make a legal challenge. Well, you could try to make a legal challenge anymore, but you won't be successful. So that's a huge point, and one that I come back to all the time now, because we're still contesting elections. The 2020 election and the special elections in Georgia, I mean, there are ongoing court cases about this that can't possibly yield any fruit, because you cannot overturn an election once the votes are certified. And the other crazy piece of all of this, the harping on fraud and the claim that with fraud, you can overturn an election result. Let's construct a scenario that's not true, But let's imagine I found 15,000 fraudulent votes in Georgia. The margin of victory was 12,000 votes, rounding up. Had I found 15,000 fraudulent votes and the Trump campaign went to court with ironclad proof that those 15,000 votes were fraudulent, neither the Trump campaign nor anybody else could show the court that those votes went against Trump. Because when we vote anonymously. We cannot tie a ballot that's cast by me. Nobody can tell once that vote is put into the machine and tie that vote back to me.
If somebody voted in both Louisiana and Georgia, and you see 10,000 of those in Georgia, you don't know if those are Trump votes or Biden votes.
Right. And in my experience, and over the years, I found 10,000 fraudulent votes over the years taken across multiple states. You know, it doesn't add up to, although in Florida in 2016, I found 2,200 duplicate votes. And remember that Bush v. Gore was decided by 547 votes. So in crazy, crazy close elections, something like this can be a factor. But again, I have to come back to the statement that because we don't know for whom the voters who committed the fraud cast the vote, the candidate can't show the court that they were harmed by that vote and therefore would probably not get the relief that they were looking for to either redo the election or for sure overturn the election result.
Another theme, I think, of your book is that the data as we currently collect it is incomplete and not systematic enough across the country for us to really do some of the kinds of investigations that we want, like, for example, anything that involves multiple states. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah. So if I'm going to categorize how states communicate through data the results of their elections, there's really two main flavors. You have data that's delivered immediately after the election, and then you have data that's delivered months after the election. And immediately after the election, the only data available is mail ballot data. One of the big challenges is that not only do the states handle mail ballots in some cases dramatically different from each other, the processes they follow and everything else, but in the case of a lot of states, the counties in those states handle mail ballots differently from county to county for the counties that are part of the same state. So for me to look at the entire country's mail ballot results immediately after the election required looking at about 500 different mail ballot files with different formats of those files, varying levels of information communicated in those files. It's a mess. And it's a bad mess and one that really shouldn't stand because there's two things really going on here. And I've already told you that to contest the election, you have to do it before the votes are certified. No state makes the in-person vote data available until after the certification is made. So fundamentally, you have a problem. How can you offer an ability to contest an election without providing the data you need to actually contest the election? So that's one basic fundamental problem that's out there with data.
We do recounts. That happens very quickly in most cases. And I think what you're talking about is this category of fraud. And fortunately, there isn't much fraud. There's vanishingly small amounts of it as far as we can determine. So, I mean, I guess there could be much more sophisticated operators trying to commit fraud down the road. And there are some advantages to decentralization too. Like even though there's about a billion different vendors working with all these counties and so on, there are some vulnerabilities to a centralized system, right? Like on balance, are you sure that nationalizing
100%
is yes. In our benefit?
County governmental computer systems are usually a backwater technologically.
The little counties for sure, yeah.
Well, even the bigger ones. And on the threat scale, with so many different systems, there are dramatically varying different levels of technical competency, security, and all the other things that come along with it. We are much better off having a single system run the right way to solve a lot of the problems that we have. I firmly believe that federalizing voter registration is the absolute right thing to do. It solves so many of the problems that we have out there with duplicate registrations. You only have one place where you have to remove deceased voters. And some states do a really good job of removing deceased voters, and some states do an absolutely terrible job at removing deceased voters. In fact, in Pennsylvania, I was part of a court case where we identified to Pennsylvania election workers more than 20,000 deceased voters.
Now, of course, that doesn't matter unless someone votes them, which rarely do.
Well, it actually can matter a lot, because as people become aware that these weaknesses are there, it's like leaving your car window rolled down with the keys in the ignition. In most circumstances, the car is not going to be stolen, but somebody is going to ultimately look at that and go, if no one's around, I could probably get away with this without getting into trouble.
But it's one thing to break into a car and get something good out of it. It's another thing to commit a felony to get one vote, right?
Well, I mean, just remember that, as I describe in the book, I was able to, through this Pennsylvania work, I identified two fraudulent votes cast on behalf of deceased voters before they were cast. With those 20,000, if somebody was manically determined to monkey around with an election, what we also showed, though, was that those votes, even though they were identified to election workers, with enough time to do something about them, nothing was done. If somebody in Pennsylvania had wanted to go and try to do something crazy, like produce 5,000 deceased votes, the fact that those deceased voters who were identifiable, I did it, weren't removed, is an election integrity problem. And because our elections are so fraught, and because they can be so close in nature in terms of their outcomes, anything that we can and should do to make them better, it's incumbent on us to do so.
The most persuasive thing to me in your book about why not to worry about fraud and having happened on a mass scale in 2020 was the comparison that you made with the previous election and the demonstration that where votes changed was actually broad-based. It was a swing towards the Democrats that happened in red counties. It happened in blue counties. In fact, it happened more in red counties. You would have had to like game every system all around the country to get a result like that. That would be much more impossible than what Trump, I think, imagined in his head, that like the cities are going to throw a whole lot of votes at the Democrats. You don't see that. You actually see him doing a little better in the cities.
Right. So let's talk about what actually happened. Why did Trump lose? You touched on it. There was a nationwide trend. When you look at Trump's performance in terms of his share of the vote in 2020 versus 2016, you can see a nationally quantifiable trend on a nationwide basis, on a state basis, and on a county basis, that he did roughly 2.5% less well across the board, except for a small number of exceptions. What is that? Well, let's talk about what it adds up to, and then I'll tell you what it is. So that 2.5% in the reddest counties in Georgia, counties that went for Trump in 16 and 20, Trump left behind about 100,000 votes in those counties by doing 2.5% less well across the board in 2020. And Georgia was determined by 12,000 votes. What that was, and that's my determination, Trump's pollsters' determination, and Georgia Secretary of State's Raffensperger's determination, is that those voters were Republicans who left Trump. And that, more importantly, they were the moderate Republicans that Trump denigrates as rhinos who abandoned Trump. Trump told them to take a hike and they did.
They voted Republican lower down on the ticket.
That's right. They voted lower down on the ticket and they either cast no vote for president or, in a disastrous outcome, it's already disastrous enough they didn't vote for Trump, but if they actually voted instead for Biden, that's a two-vote swing. So that happened without a doubt, and 100% is the reason that he lost. The ironic thing about all of this is Trump's pollster is one of the top pollsters in the country. And he saw this, he described it. There's a whole Politico.com on their website. They have his document that was a private document delivered to the campaign in December 2020 that lays it right out there plain as day. And ever since, Trump has done nothing to bring these voters back into the fold. In fact, he's probably almost cemented for sure the fact that they probably won't come back into the fold. It wasn't enough to win back in 2020, just MAGA. And I don't think that MAGA is enough now to win. Although there's some new, you know, twists to this whole election coming up. Biden's apparent fragility is a problem, you know, and if Biden falls down on live TV and breaks a hip, the election is probably over, right?
So I spent enough time in political science grad school studying elections to understand that people are constantly realigning. People are moving from one party to another individually and in areas, and there's lots of patterns and a lot of change. We see some people moving away from Biden. We see some people moving towards Trump. That's just normal, normal politics. Some people got mad about Gaza or something. And I suggest people read the book to understand in great detail what you did, because it's worth it. You got this very intimate exposure to our election systems that continued what you did before and writing the book and talking about it. An important part of the book is suggesting what we should do about it. I think it's important to say we don't have a big fraud problem, but we do have a problem with people not trusting the elections, and that we should do everything to make them more transparent and clear and make it easier for people to vote and express their preferences. That's part of being in a democracy. What do you suggest ought to be done?
Let's attack the biggest problem that we have. And our biggest problem by far is the fact that our elections have become uncompetitive. This presidential election coming up, it's a foregone conclusion who's going to win 45 of the 50 states. Five or six states is where the election is going to be determined. That's not competitive. Congress has the vast majority of its seats in a situation where they're not competitive. We know that a party owns those seats dependably. That's a problem. And the way we get non-competitive elections, well, sure, we have urban versus rural divide for sure. That's some part of it. But a bigger part of it is the really awful policy of gerrymandering, election laws passed by whatever party happens to be in power that disadvantages everyone else, right? And so I think competition is good. It's good in the marketplace. It's good for a great many things. And it's going to be really good for our political system if we can ever get out of our own way and make some of these races competitive again, because the less competitive our elections are, the more extreme the candidates are going to become who represent us. I see that as the most important thing that we can do. Getting further into it, and there are other things that we should do. For example, I believe strongly that voter registration shouldn't be left to states and counties. I think we should have a federalized voter registration system, so that we have one place close to the federal databases we need to make sure we do a good job removing deceased voters and everything else that needs to happen. And most importantly, I think that we should actually do away with the concept of a registration. The Constitution says that if you're born here, if you're naturalized, you can vote. So I think that we should confer a voter identification number to every person upon birth or naturalization, and do away with the idea that they have to take a specific action to register. That way we clean up all of the problems with duplicate registrations in multiple states and all of the integrity issues that come about with different states doing the same thing in different ways and all that other kind of stuff. In the absence of that, there is a consortium of states called ERIC that exists. And by the way, it shows you that Democratic states consider the problem of integrity important enough that they participate, and Republicans used to participate and they stopped for political reasons, but they participate in a consortium of states to share data in an effort to help them clean up their own voter rolls. And I'm going to rely on that to push back on any claim that integrity issues aren't that important. They really are. That shouldn't be a nonprofit driven consortium with voluntary compliance by states to participate. I think that the Election Administration Commission, Election Assistance Commission, which is a federal agency, an independent agency of the government, they should perform the function that Eric is performing. And it should be mandatory for every state to participate and to provide clean data to the EAC so they can do the work that Eric is trying to do. New York State doesn't participate. And the reason they don't isn't because they're not a democratic state. They are. They don't participate because their data is so dirty and so bad that Eric can't use it. And the reason I say that, and the reason I know I'm right, is that Eric relies on social security numbers in the voter registration database so that they can compare two voters in two different places to see if it's the same person or different. Well, it turns out New York State has 3 million voters, 2 million of whom voted in 2020, who don't have socials or driver's licenses in their database, their voter registration database. Doesn't mean those voters don't have that information. It means that New York State the voter registration database, doesn't have that information. So New York State has a gigantic problem. They can't uniquely identify their voters because you can't do it just with a date of birth and a name. You'd need a social or a driver's license to credibly know that and uniquely identify a person. Without that information, New York State has a wickedly hard problem in determining whether or not their voters are deceased.
This is because these are people who registered before the Help America Vote Act?
That's going to be a component of it. Although when I looked, I also saw there were a lot of voters being registered by New York State after the Help America Vote Act, who still didn't have that. But that's happened in Rhode Island as well. So I don't know.
These are basically people who are known in their precinct as people who live there, but they just don't work well with the database because you don't have enough on them. And that's a problem around the country, right? In different states, a different amount.
The percentage of voters in New York State that don't have this information is extraordinary. It is by far, from everything I know, the worst. There are some states that only have unknown voters like this to the tune of 0.5%, maybe 1%. New York's percentage is far higher than that. It's an extraordinary problem.
You end the book, I think, with the words, "I'm an optimist." No one goes out with a book like this and tries to make change in the country without thinking that it might happen, right? Without thinking that you're not wasting your time completely. Tell me why you're optimistic and what you think are sort of the strengths of our system that might prevail.
I think, especially when it comes to conversations about integrity, in my conversations with Democratic leaders, Democratic secretaries of state, when you really get down to brass tacks talking about things like voter identification and some other things, they all know and understand that the way we are doing things right now is really antiquated and is not the best solution for how to conduct an election. With the right framing and the right description of the problem and coming at it from a nonpartisan, let's make things better viewpoint, I know that I personally can make the case on a number of election reforms that this is a good thing to do and here's why we should do it. And because some of these topics have resonance on both sides of the political divide, I think it's possible to potentially get some agreement and get something.
I mean, it does feel like it has the potential for one of these grand bargains in politics where you upgrade the fraud safety and you expand the ability, like getting rid of registration, like you suggest, which removes a barrier to voting for a certain number of people, that together maybe could go through at some point and would improve the system for everybody.
So, you know, what's really interesting when it comes to voter ID and the concerns about folks who don't have ID, or in the case of, how many people can't figure out how to get registered, I keep looking for some kind of documentation that says, here's what the numbers actually are. I believe the numbers are small and dwindling. And at some point, I believe we're going to be in a scenario where, it's really hard to live in this country at this point and receive government services and not have, for example, a social security number.
But we have, from what I've seen, in excess of 10 million people without state ID who are not receiving services, who are left out of the system. And there are groups that spend all their time, I've talked to several of them, Spread the Vote, who spend all their time just trying to assist individuals. And they've done 12,000 of them over 5 years a tiny proportion of the people missing them, they're working pretty hard at that problem, and it's still a pretty substantial one.
If you have some citations for that, I'd love to see it. But I've looked pretty hard for rigorous citations that document it, and I'm familiar with some court cases regarding this sort of thing, and the numbers are far lower than that with credible numbers anyway than what you said so far. I'm open to the conversation about it, but I do think that I don't think the numbers are nearly as large as what you say they are. If they are, then you know it certainly is a substantial problem. I also wonder how many of those people have the ability or willingness to actually be voting. There's a lot of uncertainty in all of that, foundationally, most importantly, because I just haven't seen a really good quantification of who it is. Are they really trying to vote and everything else? If they really do want to vote, there are ways to get them the documentation they need to participate. New York's going to have to clean up their data at some point and deal with 3 million voters. We can deal, especially if that number 10 million is spread out across all the states. It is possible to solve that problem also.
I can't help but ask you one more question. What has surprised you the most about, after you released this book, about what people are asking you or what feedback you're getting?
There's a fascination, obviously, with the whole Trump angle and what I was asked to do. Why were the fraud claims as wrong as they were? What was going on from my view of what was happening behind the scenes, that sort of thing? By far, the most interesting part for me is I've heard from Republican and Democrat secretaries of state who both believe that the ideas I have are sound. And that gives me a lot of hope.
Well, Ken, thanks for coming to talk to me. Anything else you want to say?
I think we covered it pretty well. Thanks for the time. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
That was Ken. He is at simpaticosoftware.com. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found. The Great Battlefield is now part of the Democracy Group podcast network. Visit democracygroup.org to learn more about other podcasts that cover democracy and civic engagement. You can also help me by leaving comments and good ratings on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere, and by sending me suggestions for great guests to nperlman@gmail.com.